Chapter 38, At the Abode of Bliss. The first thing we did on arriving at Anandashram was to hand over all our money to Ram Dass and ask him to let us stay for as long as it lasted, or until he thought it was time for us to be on our way. The next was to devise a routine for ourselves. Now that we had come to live within the radiant orbit of two beings who had realized the truth, conditions for spiritual practice were even more propitious than they had been in Muvataputsa, and we wanted to make full use of our opportunity. Such a priya would have had us go into complete seclusion, cutting off all contact with the other inmates of the ashram, but of this Ram Dass did not approve. However, we were allocated one of the more remote bungalows and had our meals brought to us, instead of taking them in the communal dining hall, as on our first visit. Rising before dawn each morning, we devoted the first hours of the day to meditation. After breakfast, we went for a walk. The purpose of the walk was twofold. Besides giving exercise, it provided us with an opportunity for learning by heart the verses of the Dhammapada. Stepping briskly out along the road, we flung to the breezes of the North Malabar coast the deathless words that had not been heard there for 1,000 years. Originally, it had been our intention to memorize the whole work, such a prayer having calculated that, as there were 26 chapters, and as we could easily memorize one chapter a day, it would be possible for us to have the entire Dhammapada at the tip of the tongue within a month. As neither of us knew Pali, we had to learn the verses parrot fashion, with only a general idea of their meaning. Progress was therefore much slower than we had hoped. Though Satchapriya did rather better, I thought I was doing quite well if I committed one verse to memory each day. By the time we returned to the ashram, everybody would be ready for the mid-morning bhajan. With Ram Dass sitting in an armchair and the devotees ranged in his semicircle at his feet, this was a simple, homely occasion, almost like family prayers. A young man with a fine voice, who had been nicknamed the Nightingale of the Ashram, sang two or three devotional songs, including a setting of a long English poem by Ram Dass. The devotees chanted the Rama mantra in chorus, and sweets that had been converted to prasad by Ram Dass's touch were distributed to young and old alike. Afterwards, Ram Dass remained seated in his armchair. Anyone who wanted to speak to him could then do so. As at least two or three people always stayed behind for this purpose, and as one question invariably led to another, a general discussion soon arose. In response to a specific request, or in order to illustrate a particular point that he wished to make, Ram Dass frequently related anecdotes from his own past experience. Many of these we already knew, being familiar with them from our reading of In Quest of God and its sequel, In the Vision of God. But funny as the anecdotes were to read, they were infinitely more funny when heard from Ram Dass's own lips. Such was his excellence as a raconteur, and so great were his gifts of humour and mimicry, that when he related some old favourite, the most serious-minded devotee could not help smiling, while others, more susceptible, burst into roars of laughter, or rolled helplessly on the ground. The most mirth-provoking anecdotes were often the most meaningful. One related to the occasion when, waking up one morning in his mountain cave after years of wholehearted devotion, he found that his ego had disappeared. Ram Dass searched high and low, he declared amidst laughter, suiting his actions to the words with indescribably comic effect. But he couldn't find the fellow anywhere, and he hasn't been able to find him since. With Ram Dass constantly regaling the devotees with anecdotes of this kind, Anandashram, the abode of bliss, indeed lived up to its name. If Anandamayi's method was that of spiritual flirtation, Ram Dass's was that of transcendental comedy. At the same time, his fundamental seriousness was never in doubt. Glad as he was to help people laugh their way to God, he was firm, even strict, in his adherence to principles, and the decided enemy of all weakness and compromise. One day a devotee asked why it was that, while so many embarked on the spiritual life, so few seemed to make any real progress. Ram Dass's reply was unequivocal. They failed to make any real progress for two reasons, he said. Firstly, because they had no clear idea of the goal they wished to reach. Secondly, because they had no clear idea of how to get there. This was a warning to all happy-go-lucky aspirants, and, conscious as we were of the danger of allowing ourselves simply to drift, Satyapriya and I took it very seriously indeed. Before many mornings had passed, some of the devotees had started speaking to us after the bhajan and inviting us back to their quarters for a cup of coffee. Satyapriya at first was inclined to rebuff these friendly advances. Though better tempered than before, he was still quick to imagine that people looked down on him, and that they were out to expose his lack of knowledge, or to humiliate him in some other way. In the atmosphere of Anandashram, however, doubts and suspicions of these kind could not last for long. Soon we had not only accepted the invitations, but started making friends among the devotees. Most of them were elderly and retired, and several had brought their families with them. Nearly all came from northwestern India. One, in fact, was the ruler of Porbandar in Gujarat, the state in which Mahatma Gandhi had been born. With his military moustache, erect bearing, and dark western suit, he cut a rather odd figure at the ashram, but there was no doubting the depth of his devotion to Ram Dass. Reserved, almost diffident in manner, he very rarely spoke, and I got the impression that he was by nature rather shy. Our chief friend was a retired college principal, a Sindhi, who wanted to give up the world and become a monk, but whom Ram Dass discouraged from taking this step. Thin, silver-haired, and bespectacled, he was a sweet-natured person with unusually intense feelings. While talking, he often adopted an attitude of ecstatic devotion, falling on one knee, clasping his hands, and gazing fervently upwards. This attitude, which he sometimes maintained for minutes on end, at first struck us as rather artificial, not to say theatrical, but we eventually realized that it was not only quite genuine, but, for our good friend, the perfectly natural expression of his feelings. One of the most interesting figures at the ashram was a thin, black-skinned youngster of 13 or 14, known as the Boy Yogi. As he spoke only Tamil, we could not speak to him, but he grinned at us good-naturedly whenever we met, and one day Ram Dass told us his story. His father had wanted to become a monk, but being forced by his family to get married, had transferred his spiritual ambitions to his son. By the time the boy was 4, he had not only taught him to meditate, but had constructed for him, at the bottom of the garden, a kind of underground cave. In this cave the boy lived. Most of his time was spent practicing pranayama and similar exercises. As the years went by, the fame of the spiritual prodigy who lived in the underground cave started to spread, and the young ascetic became widely known in the Tamil-speaking areas as the Bala Yogi, or Boy Yogi. By the time he was 8, an ashram had grown up round the mouth of the cave, and there were a number of devotees. The boy yogi became a guru. The father's ambitions were fulfilled. Eventually, however, outraged nature started to take her revenge. Mainly on account of the prolonged practice of pranayama, the boy yogi suffered nervous breakdown and went mad, and after 2 or 3 years of acute mental distress had recently been brought to Ram Dass for treatment. Since his arrival at the ashram, his condition had improved considerably, Ram Dass told us, but it would be a long time before he was restored to normality. No less interesting than the boy Yogi was an elderly ascetic who lived at the foot of the hill, in a cave formed by a cleft in the rock. Though he came only occasionally to the ashram and did not talk much with anyone, he always greeted Satchapri and me in a friendly, almost conspiratorial fashion, as if there was a secret understanding between us. Apart from a scanty saffron loincloth, his principal clothing consisted of row upon row of rudraksha beads, which he wore hanging round his neck and twisted round his arms and waist. With him in the cave lived a huge cobra, who not only shared the milk with which the ashram supplied him, but coiled up beside him at night on the rude stone couch that was the cave's sole furniture. Only a few yards from the Bhajan Hall stood the bungalow that housed the ashram library. Our Sindhi friend, who was known to everyone as Dadaji, or Grandfather, was the librarian. Every two or three days, Satchapri and I would spend half an hour browsing round the shelves and looking for something to take back with us to our bungalow. Though most of the books dealt with religion and mysticism, they had been donated by different people at different times and formed a very miscellaneous collection. Among the old favourites that I was happy to meet and read again were Chuang Tzu and Lei Tzu. New discoveries included The Religion of No Religion by Frederick Spiegelberg, with the main thesis of which I found myself deeply in sympathy. Spiegelberg, a professor from Stanford University, California, had visited Anand Ashram, and Ram Dass spoke of him with high regard. Besides reading, I continued my old practice of making extracts from what I read. Indeed, shortly before our departure from Muvattaputsa, Satchapri had had made for each of us at the local press a specially bound notebook. These notebooks we had asked Ram Dass to inscribe for us. Playing on the names of Dharmapri and Satchapri, and at the same time teaching us a profound spiritual lesson, in mine he had written, "Love Dharma, for Dharma is truth." And in Satchapriya's, "Love truth, for truth is Dharma." Into my own notebook, thus blessed, I not only copied extracts from my past and present reading, but transcribed one complete work. This was Suzuki's translation of Ashvaghosha's Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana. Though I had read it before, the compactness of its style and the profundity of its teaching now impressed me more than ever, and I copied it out not only for practical reasons, so that I might have it always by me, but also as an act of merit. Both Buddhists and Hindus have long regarded the mindful transcription of sacred texts as being in itself a religious practice, and I had seen in the ashram office a number of exercise books completely filled with the Rama mantra. This was the second time in my life that I had taken the trouble of making a copy of a work I admired. The first time was when, at the age of 13 or 14, I copied from Swinburne's William Blake, a critical essay, the whole text of The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, or as much of it as Swinburne had given. On the present occasion, it was not only a matter of producing for myself a copy of a work not otherwise procurable, but of imprinting every word on it on my consciousness. Among the books that I had borrowed from the library were Ram Dass's collected articles and letters, in some of which he discussed the time-honoured themes of Indian philosophic thought with remarkable assurance and penetration. So acute was his understanding, indeed, and so clear and confident his exposition, that I could not help thinking that, though he customarily spoke the language of devotion, he was at heart not so much a bhakta, a devotee of God, as a jnanin, a knower of the Absolute. With some of his assertions, however, I could not agree. One that particularly troubled me was to the effect that the enlightened man, having transcended morality, was capable of acting either in a moral or immoral manner. He could even take life. When I raised the question with Ram Dass, he not only confirmed that this was indeed so, but having refuted all my arguments, enlarged upon the theme with his usual lucidity and radiant good humour. Finally, he insisted that, in the case of the enlightened man, the taking of life would not be a negation of compassion, but an expression of it, and summed up his position with the vigorous and uncompromising declaration, "Love can kill." This placed me in a dilemma. I was unable either to accept Ram Dass's proposition, or to say that Ram Dass himself was wrong. According to the Theravadin Pali scriptures, the Buddha had stated categorically that the Arahant, the liberated soul, was incapable of the deliberate taking of life. This seemed to me not only true in principle, but advisable in practice, so that had anyone but Ram Dass told me that love could kill, I would at once have concluded that, far from being enlightened, he was in fact labouring under a gross delusion, and that his so-called love was only a form of attachment. But in Ram Dass's case, such a conclusion was hardly possible. The assertion that love could kill was being made by one who was himself the undoubted embodiment of love. If the liberated soul was incapable of the deliberate taking of life, but if at the same time love could kill, the only conclusion that could follow was that love and enlightenment were mutually exclusive. Yet, as I well knew, according to the Mahayana scriptures, compassion was coordinate with wisdom, and both together made up perfect enlightenment or Buddhahood. Moreover, certain passages in the Mahayana scriptures suggested, or seemed to suggest, that the Bodhisattva, the living embodiment of the will to perfect enlightenment, could, out of compassion for sentient beings, abrogate the rules of morality, including even that which forbade the deliberate taking of life. Was Ram Dass a Bodhisattva then? Were the Pali scriptures wrong, and Ram Dass and the Mahayana scriptures right? Did the Buddha of the Theravada contradict the Buddha of the Mahayana? Struggling with these and many other similar questions, I only impaled myself more firmly than ever on the horns of the original dilemma. Indeed, I was to remain impaled there for many years. Every now and then in his conversations with us, Ram Dass would speak of the various saints and sages he had met in the course of his early wanderings. The one for whom he felt the greatest veneration was Ramana Maharshi, whose blessings he had sought at the outset of his quest. For Sri Aurobindo, too, whom he had not met, he entertained feelings of great regard. As Ramana Maharshi lived at Tiruvannamalai, and Sri Aurobindo in Pondicherry, while Ram Dass himself lived at Kanhangad, he used to refer to the three of them as the Trimurti of the South, the Trimurti or Trinity in question being, of course, that of the three principal deities of the Hindu pantheon, Brahma the creator, Vishnu the preserver, and Shiva the destroyer. Ramana Maharshi was Vishnu, he declared. Firm and immovable as the central axis of the cosmos, he remained ever in one place and supported all. Sri Aurobindo was Shiva. He was the great yogi, ever absorbed in contemplation. As for himself, he was Brahma. Naturally active, like a child, he did nothing but play. One day, when we had been at the ashram for about 6 weeks, Ram Dass told us that, having seen one member of the Trimurti, it was time we started thinking of seeing the other two. A date was accordingly fixed for our departure. Though sorry to leave, we knew it was Ram Dass's regular practice not to allow anyone to settle down at the ashram. Occasional visits, during the whole period of which one felt uplifted and inspired, were in his opinion of far greater value than a protracted stay, in the course of which one gradually reverted to more worldly attitudes. In our case, we had benefited enormously from our contact with Ram Dass and Krishna Bai, and having received so much, it was surely now incumbent upon us to give it effective expression in the life to which we had dedicated ourselves. Since we had no money, we had decided to walk all the way to Tiruvannamalai, a distance of about 400 miles. When we went to pay our last respects to Ram Dass, however, he handed us 2 third-class railway tickets and told us firmly that we were to go by train.